Content warning. Today's episode of Catch 22, Chapter 4, contains references to harmful humor practices, death, war, infanticide, humor as a coping tool for trauma, miscarriage, and disconnected scenarios, and how that can play a role in how people express themselves with humor.
Hey, folks, Dave here.
And Rue.
And welcome to So Many Books.
So Little Time.
Please join us for Chapter 4 of Catch 22 by Joseph Heller.
Cue music.
Good morning, Rue. I almost went into a Robin Williams there, but I decided not to stretch it out.
No, we have enough war references happening in the book.
You know, that's probably what it is. My mind just, Catch 22, Good Morning Vietnam.
Yes, it does make sense. It all does add together.
And they are both kind of absurd, although I remember when I did watch Good Morning Vietnam, I think I was in my late teens, early 20s. I remembered it, you know, Robin Williams film. Oh, about he's a radio presenter during the Vietnam War. This should be funny. And it was, but kind of like Dead Poets Society. Oof, there's some heavily emotional drama in this war film. Who would have thunk it?
That did tend to be his preference, where he would tackle very heavy topics, and then there would be, like, absurd, silly humor. But you could say that it was, interesting. I'm sure someone's done an analysis of those kind of roles that Robin Williams has done. But he does it really, he did it very well.
Yeah, I think it's also because, like, the comedy comes from just his mind and how silly and off the wall he is and how he just doesn't stop. But he also, I think, just as a person, or at least as an actor, he had a lot of empathy. So even though the man was very silly, I guess the idea was like, you put this person in the serious scenario, sure, they're going to be funny, but they're going to give the moments the gravitas there that are needed.
It's very, he was as is said in German, and often in the Jewish diaspora, he was a real mensch. Like, he was really, like, there was something very human about him, which is great. I mean, obviously human, but there's something very humane, I guess, about even his most absurd humor. There was probably that. I wonder if that's what made him such a good actor and comedian. I mean, he was an actor, but it also made him such a good storyteller and such a great crafter of humor, was because there was this grain of truth in everything he did.
And his, I think, his quickness as well, his mind, where you
you have a brilliant mind, and then you combine it with a very rapid kind of sharp, I mean, a rapier kind of sharp wit with humor as a coping strategy and also as a story tool. Yeah, it's definitely that. It's fascinating. Mm. But yes, if you think about, looking at Catch 22, you can see where this is trying to be communicated also by the author. Like, there's a desperate humor, if that makes sense. That's probably why I'm not as quick to laugh to things. It's because I can see that desperate need to cope with this. We didn't look up whether Heller had served. We probably need to, because I think that would explain a lot about the way he's writing.
The term gallows humor came to mind as you were saying that, you know, because Yossarian's plight is that he wants to get 50 missions so he can go home. Of course, part of the absurdity is that we learned in the last chapter that even if he gets 50, he might not be able to go home. There's plenty of people in his base that have 50, and now they're shambling around like zombies because they have nothing to work towards, I guess. They're kind of in a limbo. And he's a very brash and infuriating person to everyone around him, and I find a lot of his antics funny, and I find a lot of the stories funny, but it does, yeah, it feels like, you know, sometimes things are so bad that all you can do is laugh at them to keep yourself sane.
There's a desperation in the jokes. There's a desperation, and we're not talking, not desperate to get a laugh.
Mm.
It's desperate to a survival kind of humor, which is, it's a particular flavor, and I think only other people who've been through, obviously, I personally haven't been through the suffering that war specifically presents, but that kind of, I imagine that if someone who has experienced this reads it and sees the humor, they'll probably identify a lot of it as what it is. And anyone who's been through some sort of suffering that's significant and understands how humor is used to cope, doesn't necessarily make humor appropriate or healthy or anything like that, or inoffensive or harmless. It's not. Like, it, to some extent, a lot of these things can be very harmful, especially when we forget. Like, it's easy to forget that the humor that we create, that we generate, is shaped by our existing prejudices and biases,
mm-hmm.
and priorities. Like, if your priority is only about you and your survival, then sometimes your humor will be at the expense of the well-being of others.
Mm.
And that can be seen. And that's why humor is an interesting one, because of the fact that that's what happens. It's the same way that, you know, jokes about race, there's a huge pile of literature now to indicate that just deflecting it as humor, saying, oh, it's just a joke, that kind of thing. So gender, race, sex, what, all these things. And this isn't to say you can't make jokes. It's just to say that when you're making jokes, to just assume that, oh, but it's a joke, therefore it's harmless, is very wrong.
I've got a good personal story about that, because... Mm. Yeah, I definitely was in that camp. In my early 20s, I loved shock humor. My shock humor of preference was dead baby jokes.
Hmm.
And I would, you might even remember this, I would tell anybody these jokes at glee, because I loved how uncomfortable they made certain people. I loved just I think also the premise that, you know, the fact I'm laughing at this book, I talk about absurdity a lot. I do like my, the flavor of humor that I, even though I've grown past a lot of my shock humor, this is an aside, I'm going to come back to the story. I'm sorry. This is how my mind works. It's just like, you know, what's being said or the premise of the joke itself is often like intellectually, I find it so ridiculous. That's what makes it funny. The idea that it's so otherworldly, yet
it's disconnected. There's a disconnect.
But there's still what you talked about earlier, that grain of truth, like the idea, well, let's not deconstruct what's funny behind a dead baby joke, so I'll just go back to my story. So I was telling these to everyone, even my parents' friends, and then one day my mom pulls me aside and goes, yeah, my friends who you told that joke to, I'd like it if you didn't do that anymore. They had a miscarriage once upon a time. And I think that was that, I can call that, that was the end of me telling dead baby jokes. It was that idea that I saw that, oh, I like this humor because I think, yeah, it's disconnected. It's ridiculous. The scenarios in these jokes are just so abhorrent that it's like, you can never take them as real. And that's part of the humor. But then the fact that the basis of the joke itself was something that someone had lived through and they had a lot of pain towards that, and I probably contributed to that, that made me go, oh, crap, yeah, okay, I can't do this anymore.
Yeah, it makes us question. I think it's important. We discussed this before, this idea of why. Like, when people say, I want to be able to use that word, and that nigga, but why? And then we don't examine the why. We don't examine, like, not, this is the we being, like, in general and on usual behavior doesn't. Like, we're not encouraged usually to examine why we say certain things, why we find certain things humorous, why something could be harmful, why something could be uplifting and supporting, why is something like we don't look at that enough. Like, I think it's probably because so here's a total speculative theory, and it's not real but fun. So, you know, when you're two or three, you go through the why phase, and we get parents just driven to distraction, and teachers everyone's just driven to distraction by the why phase. I think we need to stay in the why phase, but we also need to learn to, we're now older, we need to actually go back to why, and we also need to look up things.
Instead of asking why to other people, we get to a stage where we can start to question ourselves. And we're not bothering anyone else by continually questioning ourselves.
But the other thing is, it shouldn't be a bother. I mean, we need to find a better way to respond to the wine phase in children.
When it comes to humor, though, I think the reason so many folks don't even want to question it is because laughter is an involuntary response. You don't think about, I'm going to laugh. I mean, sometimes both of us do this, something funny will happen and we'll vocalize, oh, that was really clever, that was very funny, instead of laughing. Like, sometimes things hit you on an intellectual humor level rather than that involuntary laugh. But when you actually do laugh, it is a spontaneous thing that happens. And I think because the reasons why that was triggered are subconscious. And things can get dicey once you start questioning your subconscious behavior.
You just did it. Like, why that humor was, like, why it was humorous to you, or why it remained humorous to you at the time, was because it was disconnected from your reality.
Mm.
There was an absurd level to it.
And However, I thought, there is no way I can actually hurt anyone with this. It's just shocking.
Well, the thing is, we view the world from our perspective. And that's the other thing with the why.
Mm-hmm.
We view the world so heavily from our perspective and our experiences that it's the same way, like, that's never happened to me, therefore it isn't a thing.
Yeah.
It's a very prevalent mindset. Mm-hmm. And that's a three-year-old. That's literally, you're meant to grow out of that phase when you are three.
Yeah.
But we still seem to retain it as a society a little bit too much. Mm. We've brought this up, this individualism versus collectivism, and whether both extremes are not helpful. But at the same time, when we're looking at individualism, if it's only about me and how I perceive the world and how I feel, yeah, that's limiting. And that's what we are encouraged to do a lot of the time, because it's hard to see. But that's, at least in terms of humor, that's often what dictates it and what drives it. But it does. I think the more we pause and we think and we go, okay, you know, why is this kind of humor no longer really, like, it wasn't appropriate at the time either. The thing is that we didn't have that realization necessarily until later, because we kind of went, huh, let's have a look at how other people's experiences and things inform this as well.
Mm.
Which is why it's a whole, you know, it doesn't make a person a bad person. What I think, there's that good and bad business needs to, if you don't pause and learn and actually think about the impact of your actions, then that makes you a thoughtless person.
Mm.
Then it makes you an unkind and compassionate, like someone who is deficient in compassion and understanding and empathy. And then you have to decide whether it reconciles with who you want to be as a person, like, and what you value in yourself as well, versus what society might encourage you to develop, you know, kind of, it's a whole, you could go down into a whole bunch of rabbit holes into this. And it's not about this judgment to punish, but judgment to learn, judgment to grow and change.
And there's also the tricky part about dissecting humor. There is a joke about that where, you know, dissecting humor is a lot like dissecting a frog. Nobody laughs and the frog still dies.
Yes. Yeah, it's
We're being killjoys.
I know. Look, I'm if someone laughs at something and it's this is not someone not about telling another person what they can and cannot laugh at, because a lot. I mean, I inappropriately laugh about my health conditions all the time.
That's very similar to gallows humor, isn't it?
It is gallows humor. Patients have gallows humor, specifically patients who are chronic, patients who are disabled population is some of the darkest humor you would imagine, but it has to be about you.
Mm.
It can't be humor at the expense of another. And I think that's the difference. When you have humor at the expense and the suffering of another, I mean, there's a whole bunch of comedians who've been talking about this more recently, this idea of punch up, don't punch down. And even when you're punching up, think about the fact that how you're punching up, because you are punching up in a way that you're punching up towards someone you perceive as having more power or rights or whatever, but that's your perception of the situation. It doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have, you can't judge, basically. You can't gauge whether they are up or down or left or right or whatever. It's hard to see. There, you can mock ideologies. You can mock things that are harmful. You can mock all sorts of stuff. But again, from whose perspective is it harmful? If it's at the expense of another person's well-being, yeah, okay, fair. Good go. Go for it. You know, but don't make your humor at the expense of another person. Mock the ideologies that feel like they can. You're talking about it before. I don't know if this was on the podcast or if this was in our conversation before. Like that idea of sin.
That was it was a Discworld quote from Granny Weatherwax where she says, "Sin is treating people as things, and that's as simple as it is." Like a priest tries to argue it's more complicated, and she's like, "Maybe, but that's where it starts: treating people as things."
Yeah, it's like, I'm sure there's more to it and there's spiritual things and there's a lot more. But if you boil it down to it, when you are treating a person as an object for your humor, for your expense, for you.
Or
as
a an people. Object,
or a group of people, yes. Or like if you can't differentiate between a human being capable of so many things that are also helpful and kind reducing people to a thing is definitely a big part of it. Yeah. So sorry. On that note, we now enter Catch-22 where, I mean, just technically the author is doing that. He is reducing people to punchlines in a sense. But he's doing it in a way because he's also trying to say, like, everyone is basically, they're treating themselves as objects. They themselves have. Actually, I wonder if that reflects the fact that people are treated as objects and pawns and just consumable, reduced down
In war, there is definitely a thing about, you know, the higher ups wield all the power, but you're usually not the ones doing the actual fighting.
No.
And in that last chapter, we learned like some of the drama between two of the generals, and we learned like kind of the hierarchy above Ysarian's group. But when you've talked about the humor, I think the thing in Catch-22 that I've gotten so far from this reread is that every member of that company thinks they're sane and everyone else is crazy.
Yes. And the humor is definitely, I mean, humor could be the author themselves trying to cope with this, but it also seems to be used in a very interesting way to depict the fact that they are being dehumanized. They are being treated as objects for the machinery of war.
Yeah.
I mean, if they don't care, like as long as you are productive, as long as you do your job the way they need you to do it, as long as you respond, oh, well, we need to do something for their morale, so therefore they must attend this thing. It's not compulsory, but it's compulsory.
Yes. And that was the same guy who made the, it was part of the same speech. You're Americans. No other fighting force on the world can say that.
Yeah, it's like, that kind of thing. So it makes you, yeah. Well, let us continue, because I'm curious to see. Now we've got the next character, who's what, Dr. Nika, chapter 4. Yes.
Yeah, I don't know how far into the story we'll get these chapters that are about specific people. Although, really, the last chapter was called Havermeyer, and he really only showed up at the end.
Yeah.
So yeah. How much of this chapter will be about Dr. Nika? I mean, we know a little bit about him. In the last chapter, he lamented the Yessarian. I'm like, you think you got problems? I finally had a successful practice after years of working my way up. And what did they do? They enlist me.
Yeah, far out. Yeah.
So he's like, you know, don't come complaining to me, but aren't you the doctor? Don't come complaining to me.
So funny.
Well, he must be the head doctor, because he wasn't in the hospital at the start of the book.
No. He's with their unit.
He's like the medic, I guess, for their company.
Yeah, probably a step above, but not much, but yeah.
Okay, so Catch 22, Chapter 4, Dr. Nika. Hungry Joe was crazy, and no one knew it better than Yessarian, who did everything he could to help him. Hungry Joe just wouldn't listen to Yessarian. Hungry Joe just wouldn't listen because he thought Yessarian was crazy. Why should he listen to you? Dr. Nika inquired of Yessarian without looking up. Because he's got troubles. Dr. Nika snorted scornfully. He thinks he's got troubles. What about me? Dr. Nika continued slowly with a gloomy sneer. Oh, I'm not complaining. I know there's a war on. I know a lot of people are going to have to suffer for us to win it. But why must I be one of them? Why don't they draft some of these old doctors who keep shooting their kisses off in public about what big sacrifices the medical game stands ready to make? I don't want to make sacrifices. I want to make dough. Dr. Nika was a very neat, clean man whose idea of a good time was to sulk. He had a dark complexion with a small, wise, saturnine face with mournful pouches under both eyes. He brooded over his health continually and went almost daily to the medical tent to have his temperature taken by one of the two enlisted men there who ran things for him practically on their own, and ran it so efficiently that he was left with little else to do but sit in the sunlight with his stuffed nose and wonder what other people were so worried about. Their names were Gus and Wes, and they had succeeded in elevating medicine to an exact science. All men reporting on sick call with temperatures above 102 were rushed to the hospital. All those except Yessarian reporting on sick call with temperatures below 102 had their gums and toes painted with gentian violet solution and were given a laxative to throw away into the bushes. All those reporting on a sick call with temperatures of exactly 102 were asked to return in an hour to have their temperatures taken again. Yessarian, with his temperature of 101, could go to the hospital whenever he wanted to because he was not afraid of them. The system worked just fine for everybody, especially for Dr. Nika, who found himself with all the time he needed to watch old Major De Coverley pitching horseshoes in his private horseshoe pitching pit. Still wearing the transparent eye patch Dr. Nika had fashioned for him from a strip of celluloid stolen from Major Major's orderly room window months before, when Major De Coverley had returned from Rome with an injured cornea after renting two apartments there for the officers and enlisted men to use on their rest leaves. The only time Dr. Nika ever went to the medical tent was the time he began to feel he was a very sick man each day and stopped in just to have Gus and Wes look him over. They could never find anything wrong with him. His temperature was always 96.8, which was perfectly all right with him, as long as he didn't mind. Dr. Nika did mind. He was beginning to lose confidence in Gus and Wes, and was thinking of having them both transferred back to the motor pool and replaced by someone who could find something wrong. Dr. Nika was personally familiar with a number of things that were drastically wrong. In addition to his health, he worried about the Pacific Ocean and flight time. Health was something no one ever could be sure of for a long enough time. The Pacific Ocean was a body of water surrounded on all sides by elephantitis and other dread diseases to which, if he ever displeased Colonel Cathcart by grabbing Yessarian, he might suddenly find himself transferred. And flight time was the time he had to spend in airplane flight each month in order to get his flight pay. Dr. Nika hated to fly. He felt imprisoned in an airplane. In an airplane, there was absolutely no place in the world to go except to another part of the airplane. Dr. Nika had been told that people who enjoyed climbing into an airplane were really giving vent to a subconscious desire to climb back into the womb. He had been told this by Yusarian, who made it possible for Dan Danica to collect his flight pay each month without ever climbing back into the womb. Yusarian would persuade McWatt to enter Dr. Danica's name on his flight log for training missions or trips to Rome. "You know how it is," Dr. Danica had wheedled with a sly conspiratorial wink. "Why take chances when I don't have to?" "Sure," Yusarian agreed. "What difference does it make to anyone if I'm in the plane or not?" "No difference." "Sure, that's what I mean," Dr. Nika said. "A little grease is what makes this world go round. One hand washes the other. Know what I mean? You scratch my back, I'll scratch yours." Yusarian knew what he meant. "That's not what I meant," Dr. Nika said, as Yusarian began scratching his back. "I'm talking about cooperation. Favors. You do a favor for me, I'll do one for you. Get it? Do one for me," Yusarian requested. "Not a chance," Dr. Nika answered. There was something fearful and minute about Dr. Nika as he sat despondently outside his tent in the sunlight as often as he could, dressed in khaki summer trousers and a short-sleeved summer shirt that was bleached almost to an antiseptic gray by the daily laundering to which he had it subjected. He was like a man who had grown frozen with horror once and had never come completely unthawed. He sat all tucked up into himself, his slender shoulders huddled halfway around his head, his sun-tanned hands with their luminous silver fingernails massaging the backs of his bare-folded arms gently as though he were cold. Actually, he was a very warm, compassionate man who never stopped feeling sorry for himself.
Mm-hmm.
"Why me?" was his constant lament, and the question was a good one. Yusarian knew it was a good one because Yusarian was a collector of good questions and had used them to disrupt the educational sessions Clevenger had once conducted two nights a week in Captain Black's intelligence tent with the corporal in eyeglasses who everybody knew was probably a subversive. Captain Black knew he was a subversive because he wore eyeglasses and used words like panacea and utopia, and because he disapproved of Adolf Hitler, who had done such a great job of combating un-American activities in Germany. Yusarian attended the educational sessions because he wanted to find out why so many people were working so hard to kill him. A handful of other men were also interested, and the questions were many and good when Clevenger and the subversive corporal finished and made the mistake of asking if there were any. "Who is Spain? Why is..."
Yeah.
"Who is Spain? Why is Hitler? When is right? Where was that stupid and mealy-colored old man I used to call Papa when the merry-go-round broke down? How was Trump at Munich? Ho, ho, berry, berry, and balls." All rang out in rapid succession, and then there was Yusarian with the question that had no answer. "Where are the Snowdens of yesteryear?" The question upset them because Snowden had been killed over Avignon when Dobbs went crazy in midair and seized the controls away from Hubble. The corporal played it dumb. "What?" he asked. "Where are the Snowdens of yesteryear?" "I'm afraid I don't understand." "Où sont les Snowdens d'antan?" Yusarian said to make it easier for him. "Parlez en anglais, for Christ's sake," said the corporal. "Je ne parle pas français." "Neither do I," answered Yusarian, who was ready to pursue him through all the words in the world to wring the knowledge from him if he could. But Clevenger intervened, pale, thin, and laboring for breath, a humid coating of tears already glistening in his undernourished eyes. Group headquarters was alarmed, for there was no telling what people might find out once they felt free to ask whatever questions they wanted to. You know, earlier we were talking about little toddlers asking why and people not liking.
Yeah.
It never goes away. Colonel Cathcart sent Colonel Korn to stop it, and Colonel Korn succeeded with a rule governing the asking of questions. Colonel Korn's rule was a stroke of genius, Colonel Korn explained in his report to Colonel Cathcart. Under Colonel Korn's rule, the only people permitted to ask questions were those who never did. Soon the only people attending were those who never asked questions, and the sessions were discontinued altogether, since Clevenger, the corporal, and Colonel Korn agreed that it was neither possible nor necessary to educate people who never questioned anything. Oh, wow. Okay, I'm just going to aside here. I think that's the other thing I like about the humor in this book. It uses the ridiculousness of the situation to get at some very harsh truths. And I imagine also that, like a Robin Williams film, when there are emotional moments, because there's got to be, it's going to make them hit all the harder.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
Colonel Cathcart and Lieutenant Colonel Korn lived and worked in the group headquarters building, as did all the members of the headquarters staff, with the exception of the chaplain. The group headquarters building was an enormous, windy, antiquated structure built of powdery red stone and banging plumbing. Behind the building was the modern skeet shooting range that had been constructed by Colonel Cathcart for the exclusive recreation of the officers at group, at which every officer and enlisted man on combat status now, thanks to General Dreidel, had to spend a minimum of 8 hours a month. Yessarian shot skeet, but never hit any. Appleby shot skeet, and never missed. Yessarian was as bad at shooting skeet as he was at gambling. He could never win money gambling either. Even when he cheated, he couldn't win, because the people he cheated against were always better at cheating too. There were two disappointments to which he had resigned himself. He would never be a skeet shooter, and he would never make money. It takes brains not to make money, Colonel Cargo wrote in one of the homiletic memoranda he regularly prepared for circulation over General Peckham's signature. Any fool can make money these days, and most of them do. But what about people with talent and brains? Name, for example, one poet who makes money. T.S. Eliot, ex-PFC Wintergreen, said in his mail-sorting cubicle at 27th Air Force Headquarters and slammed down the telephone without identifying himself. Colonel Cargill in Rome was perplexed. Who was it? Asked General Peckham. I don't know, Colonel Cargill replied. What did he want? I don't know. Well, what did he say? T.S. Eliot, Colonel Cargill informed him. What's that? T.S. Eliot, Colonel Cargill repeated. Just T.S.? Yes, sir. That's all he said. Just T.S. Eliot. I wonder what it means, Colonel Peckham reflected. Colonel Cargill wondered, too. T.S. Eliot, General Peckham mused. T.S. Eliot, Colonel Cargill echoed with the same venereal puzzlement. Colonel Peckham roused himself after a moment with an unctuous and benignant smile. His expression was shrewd and sophisticated. His eyes gleamed maliciously. Have someone get me General Dreidel, he requested Colonel Cargill. Don't let him know who's calling. Colonel Cargill handed him the phone. T.S. Eliot, General Peckham said, and hung up. Who was it? Asked Colonel Moodus. General Dreidel in Corsica did not reply. Colonel Moodus was General Dreidel's son-in-law, and General Dreidel, at the insistence of his wife and against his own better judgment, had taken him into the military business. General Dreidel gazed at Colonel Moodus with level hatred. He detested the very sight of his son-in-law, who was his aide and therefore in constant attendance upon him. He had opposed his daughter's marriage to Colonel Moodus because he disliked attending weddings. Wearing a menacing and preoccupied scowl, General Dreidel moved to the full-length mirror in his office and stared at his stocky reflection. He had a grizzled, broad-browed head with iron-gray tufts over his eyes and a blunt and belligerent jaw. He brooded in ponderous speculation over the cryptic message he had just received. Slowly his face softened with an idea, and he curled his lips with wicked pleasure. Get Peckham, he turned Colonel Moodus. Don't let the bastard know who's calling. Who was it? Asked Colonel Cargill back in Rome. That same person, General Peckham replied with a definite trace of alarm. Now he's after me. What did he want? I don't know. What did he say? The same thing. T.S. Eliot? Yes, T.S. Eliot. That's all he said. General Peckham had a hopeful thought. Perhaps it's the new code or something, like the colors of the day. Why don't you have someone check with communications and see if it's a new code or something or the colors of the day? Communications answered that T.S. Eliot was not a new code or the colors of the day. Colonel Cargill had the next idea. maybe I ought to phone 27th Air Force Headquarters and see if they know anything about it. They have a clerk up there named Wintergreen I'm pretty close to. He's the one who tipped me off that our prose was too prolix. Ex-PFC Wintergreen told Cargill that there was no record at 27th Air Force Headquarters of a T.S. Eliot. How's our prose these days? Colonel Cargill decided to inquire while he had ex-PFC Wintergreen on the phone. It's much better now, isn't it? It's still too prolix, ex-PFC Wintergreen replied. It wouldn't surprise me if General Dreidel were behind the whole thing, General Peckham confessed at last. Remember what he did to that skeet shooting range? General Dreidel had thrown open Colonel Cathcart's private skeet shooting range to every officer and enlisted man in the group on combat duty. General Dreidel wanted his men to spend as much time out on the skeet shooting range as the facilities and their flight schedule would allow. Shooting skeet 8 hours a month was excellent training for them. It trained them to shoot skeet. Dunbar loved shooting skeet because he hated every minute of it and the time passed so slowly. He had figured out that a single hour on the skeet shooting range with people like Havermeyer and Appleby could be worth as much as 11 times 17 years. I think you're crazy, was the way Clevenger had responded to Dunbar's discovery. Who wants to know? Dunbar answered. I mean it, Clevenger insisted. Who cares? Dunbar answered. I really do. I'll even go so far as to concede that life seems longer. Is life longer? Is longer. Is longer. All right, is longer if it's filled with periods of boredom and discomfort. Guess how fast, Dunbar said suddenly. Huh? They go, Dunbar explained. Who? Years. Years. Years, said Dunbar. Years, years, years. Clevenger, why don't you let Dunbar alone? The Assyrian broke in. Don't you realize the toll this is taking? It's all right, said Dunbar magnanimously. I have some decades to spare. Do you know how long a year takes when it's going away? And you shut up also, the Assyrian told Orr, who had begun to snigger. I was just thinking about that girl, Orr said. That girl in Sicily. That girl in Sicily with a bald head. You'd better shut up also, the Assyrian warned him. It's your fault, Dunbar said to the Assyrian. Why don't you let him snigger if he wants to? It's better than having him talking. All right, go ahead and snigger if you want to. Do you know how long a year takes when it's going away? Dunbar repeated to Clevenger. This long, he snapped his fingers. A second ago, you were stepping into college with your lungs full of fresh air. Today, you're an old man. Old? Asked Clevenger with surprise. What are you talking about? Old. I'm not old. You're inches away from death every time you go on a mission. How much older can you be at your age? A half minute before that, you were stepping into high school, and an unhooked brassiere was as close as you ever hoped to get to paradise. Only a fifth of a second before that, you were a small kid with a 10-week summer vacation that lasted 100,000 years and still ended too soon. Zip, they go rocketing by so fast. How the hell else are you ever going to slow time down? Dunbar was almost angry when he finished. Well, maybe it is true, Clevenger conceded unwillingly in a subdued tone. Maybe a long life does have to be filled with many unpleasant conditions if it's to seem long. But in that event, who wants one? I do, Dunbar told him. Why? Clevenger asked. What else is there?
It's accurate. There's a whole thing about time perception that when you're younger, it feels a lot slower.
I've heard that's because new experiences. When yes. you're young, every experience is new, so it forms greater memories and it feels like a big adventure. And as you age, as life becomes more routine, you have less new experiences unless you forcibly
I think that's make definitely yourself part of it. To. A big yeah. part of it. I think this probably is to do with that you don't have as many. Like, I think your if your responsibilities, not to say that young people don't have responsibilities, mm-hmm. they do, but usually most young people are not responsible for, like a parent is responsible for earning enough for the household, for raising their kids. Like, so there's more, all these things to do, and then it just feels like there's never enough time.
Well, one thing I always...
Or that it just drags out your day. I don't know, there's a lot there. I like the fact that he's like, you know, the reason you're an old man is because literally any moment you go out, you could die. And isn't the whole point that when you're old, that's when you die? Yeah.
That's very philosophical then, thinking about it. Those who died before their time, It's funny, I have thought a lot about that, how, you know, some of our greatest artists died very young, and then there are other artists who don't even start until they're, like, middle-aged, and time is a very funny thing.
Time is odd.
But when you were talking about responsibilities and not having the time for new experiences, when I read a lot of people exhausted with work and just the way of the world, I often think back to a conversation we had back when we were reading 1984, and we constantly talked about how, not only with the proles in that book, but with the party members as well, everyone was kept so superficially busy, and especially the proles were just so focused on survival that no one ever had any time to think about how to improve life.
Yeah. That's a whole big thing. Oh, wow.
But yes. So that in that chapter, it did actually start with Dr. Nika, so it wasn't like the last chapter where we only got Havermeyer at the end. We started with the character who the chapter was named after, and he seems to be a bit of a hypochondriac, or at least he's been made that way.
He's either a hypochondriac or he's trying to get out, and that's the only way he can see himself as leaving, because the other options are, you know, waiting till the war's over, which probably to him feels like it's never going to happen.
Well, he also doesn't want to be transferred anywhere else because of all the diseases that could happen alongside the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, so it's like he wants to get out, and so the only thing he can think of is health, because he's obviously, doctors tend to also think in terms of, in wartime, that is one of the only two, like, there's only three ways you come back, four ways you come back from war. One, it's over. Two, you die. And three, you're seriously injured or ill or unwell. And then four would be, if you, for example, in terms of the missions, you've completed your missions, in theory. Like you've done your time, so to speak, or you've done what you need to do to get the points to leave.
You finished your service.
Yes, in theory. As we saw in the previous chapter, you may have done the tasks, but you may not be leaving just yet, because the goalposts change.
Yes.
Yeah, it's been interesting. It's
We went from Doc to Nika to, we got a little bit about the skeet shooting range, which is funny because I like the way that chapter played with how the skeet shooting range was set up, because it talked about how it was supposed to be something very special for the colonel himself. And then instantly they talked about Yusarian being very bad at skeet shooting. So in my mind, I instantly goes, well, why is Yusarian using it? And then after the whole T.S. Eliot bit, Peckham talked about how much he hated Dreidel, because Dreidel opened up his skeet shooting range to all the men because he thought it was good training. So I like how it played with how he learned about just that little element of the story, which last episode I talked a bit about how it feels like Catch-22 is like the page of a coloring book, and each chapter colors in a bit in a different location. Yeah. And this seemed to be a microcosm of the way the book seems to be doing that.
It's fascinating. Definitely. There's layers.
And then the whole T.S. Eliot bit.
That was funny. It's just like this. Yeah, it was funny. And the idea of how questions work in this, or don't work.
The training. Oh my goodness, that bit.
Even the T.S. Eliot thing, that was because of a question. Can anyone name a poet that made money from his work? And it's like, well, yeah, T.S. Eliot. So he asked a question, he got an answer. And instead of thinking, I ask a question, I get an answer. And that's what usually, you know, if I ask to ask a question, I usually expect a response. His mind was like, wait, what? Like, what's this about? Why is someone mentioning T.S. Eliot? What does this have to do with things? It's like not realizing what you actually said. If you ask a question, it's a question.
I think maybe because the answer was a disconnect, because wasn't the question written in the sheets that went out? Like, it was part of that, the quotes
he put over? I thought it was not physical, but I'll check.
Because there was that whole thing about how he put stupid little quotes at the top of, like, the reports that went out.
Yeah, I'm checking. It brings wrote, yes. He wrote in one of his memorandas he circulated. So he circulates the stuff to essentially with Peckham and yeah.
And then Wintergreen just like picks up the phone, dials, and says T.S. Eliot has an answer.
Yes, and then it and then it goes and it doesn't cycle and it comes back to Colonel Gargoyle that I'll talk to Wintergreen because he tipped us off and so it's like and then yeah and then Cargill it's because the circulation that was going around is from General Peckham
yeah
and so he just played with them
but going back to the training and the questions like. It's funny because a lot of the questions, you know, were nonsense. The officers were having fun. The whole why is Hitler? When is
yeah? This just, like but, don't just have open questions. You got specifically about like narrow down, be direct.
But even though it was kind of, I'd say it was nonsense. Yossarian really wanted his question answered.
Yeah.
And because they couldn't answer his question, or they didn't really understand what he was answering, because that seems to be part of the problem as well. Like, people like Clevenger and the higher-ups, they don't seem to actually be able to understand what Yossarian's talking about.
Well, or...
Like, or Dunbar and Yossarian seem to be on the same wavelength. Dr. Nika well, and Yossarian are able to talk to each other, although there was the funny misunderstanding of, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, Yossarian scratches well, his back.
Yeah, but he also asked a question like, where are the Snowdens of yesterday? And the question upset them because it's not that they don't know.
Right, it upset them because of how that man because died. Because
Snowden had been killed over Avignon when Dobbs went crazy in midair. So this idea of it's a bit more messy. And that it took Clevenger going, nope, we are stopping this now because this is too...
I did like how Colonel Corrin came up with that genius solution that only people who haven't been asking questions can ask questions. Yes. So everyone stopped going. And I'm like, oh, we got to shut this down. What was that line? There's that brilliant line at the end of that.
There was no point in holding the sessions if no one's asking questions.
Pretty much.
Because no one's learning. It's true. You learn by asking questions. And if no one's asking questions or they're told don't ask questions...
I'm trying to find it. Just the way it was worded. Yes. Since Clevenger, the corporal, and Colonel Corrin agreed that it was neither possible nor necessary to educate people who never questioned anything.
It's fascinating.
And so much seems to be packed into each chapter. Like, you know, it's not just about one thing. It really jumps around.
It's very all over the place, which... makes sense because it does. I mean, that's what war is as well. Like, it's like that. It's scattered and crazy.
And it still feels well. Like Yossarian's our main character, but, you know... Again, I still don't know whether, like, these impressions of all the other people, if we're meant to be... If, like, that's Yossarian's impressions of them, or if... It feels more like there isn't an omnipotent narrator who's telling us these things about what's happening... But then we're mostly following Yossarian.
I think we are, and I think Yossarian is the central, he's the key figure, the constant.
Mm.
If that makes sense. Like, it's like, there's this dude, and he's feeling isolated and lonely and lost and confused and frustrated and terrified and, like, all these feelings, and this is what, like, it's circling it around his how he perceives what's going on around him, the conversations he recalls, and the absurdity that he sees that's frustrating him and makes him more scared. But yes, so it's more afraid. But yes, I can see that. Oh, yes.
Anything else you'd like to bring
up? Not off the top of my head. I think it's interesting. Like, Dunbar's discussion on time, and then Ward is taking the time to distract again about that girl in Sicily. It's like, no, you're just stirring now.
Yeah. Or seems to maybe be a bigger shit stirrer than Yossarian is. Although, I'm getting the idea that Yossarian doesn't mean to be a shit stirrer.
No, I don't think he's doing it deliberately. He's very literal, very face value.
Now that we got some time with him, because after chapter one, you thought he was a shitster.
Yeah, he felt like a shitster, but it's like, no, he just, that's how he, yeah. He doesn't think. The fact that he scratched his back, you know, going, wow. Very literal. Very
literal. And I guess as we're going on, I'm gaining more sympathy, not just for him, but for everybody here.
I've got sympathy for all of them. It's just the higher up you go in the hierarchy, the less sympathy, because higher yes. up they're more and more financially motivated. Yeah, with the exception of Havemeyer, who's just not. I can't feel sympathy really.
What was the line about? Dunbar hated skeet shooting because he had to spend time around Havemeyer and Appleby.
Yes. Yes. There are issues. People who are true believers, so to speak. True believers in the war machine.
And Clevenger is as well, but... I don't know. It feels like... I don't know if he's emotionally unstable, but just the fact that simple questions from, like, Dunbar and Yassirium can make him tear up with, like, rage...
Yeah, he's frustrated, but he's also not very, yeah. I don't think they see him as dangerous as they see Havemeyer and Appleby, because they are, like, absolute fanatics and almost have a relish the fact that they are a cause of death.
Havemeyer is the lead bomber, but Havemeyer is also the guy who's shooting mice, right?
Yeah, he's cruel, and then Appleby is just... righteous in his behavior. He feels absolutely justified that...
I can't remember who Appleby is.
Appleby is the golden boy, neighbor dude, all-American boy.
Like the Idaho or Iowa he was, yeah.
Yeah, so he's very, very, very...
patriotic without question.
Yes, whereas Clevenger is patriotic, is whatever, but he also still has... a little bit of dialogue.
You know what I think it is? This is just speculation.
Yeah.
But I don't think Clevenger is confident. Like, he sees it as well, how insane everything is, right? And how the rules don't make sense. But I think he's a firm believer in, like, military hierarchy. The rules are here for a reason.
Yeah.
We need to follow them. This is the only thing that makes sense. And the fact that Yassirium and Dunbar and others are chipping away at him, and he's becoming distraught. He's clenching harder and harder to this belief that no, the rules, they're here, the hierarchy, it's what makes sense.
Yes, he's using the rules and the structure to try and assure himself that what he's doing is right. Whereas the others just, like, they immediately, like, they have belief. They have, like, a deep-seated, true belief in the ideology that informs, like, no, we have the right. We have the right to invade as many countries as we want and whatever, like, and do what we want. Because they need to know. They need to be, like, with Appleby, I wouldn't be surprised if you've got the whole, those heathens need to. And then you've got the, with Havemeyer, which is all the... they need to recognize their place kind of thing.
Well, like, apologies if I'm getting this wrong, but it feels like you're coming at it from, like, a modern American military perspective, you know, with America's adventures in the Middle East, and I say adventures with modern. Many air quotes, but, you know, I have to wonder I've watched lots of movies from the World War II time, but I wonder what their view of Nazi Germany was as enlisted American men.
I think it's more complicated. I don't think it's the same necessarily ideology. Like, those ideologies are generally, they're not limited to America. They are literally the attitude usually that is in the state of war. And I think that's where what I'm referring to is mainly that idea of, it came up, this idea of the ends justify the means. That came up, that And the ends justify the means, and then there's enjoying the ends that justify the means, and enjoying the means that are being used.
And the idea that, I guess it's part of jingoism, that idea where we're American, so anything we do is right.
A little bit of that, yeah. And that's, That's like blind patriarchy, patriarchy, that too. But no, it's blind patriotic kind of nationalistic kind of, you know, that might makes right. I mean, that was literally the motive, one of the mottos of the Third Reich. It was might makes right, and that's
But another thing I ask, and if you don't know, I wonder if one of our listeners can tell me. They're in Italy, and from my memory, the Italians were part of the Axis in World War II. That was Mussolini.
Yes, Mussolini. So once they secured Italy, then they...
Okay, they secured Italy, right. So this is probably final days of the war. They've got their bases in Italy. They're making sure...
Yeah, I think it was the working relationship between Italy and so Mussolini and Hitler was interesting. Yeah. And I think it was that these guys are... So you've got Sicily and Rome. Like, I don't know. My geography's not crash hot. I don't remember exactly what...
All I know is that Italy looks like a boot. That's what I remember about, like, map of Europe.
So they had a whole bunch going on and well, we've had it mentioned that essentially the Italians are being used as prisoners of war, and it's not like they went and they grabbed themselves some waiters. The way they treat the women,
The idea of going into Rome or Sicily on leave and just having fun. Even in this chapter, there was the thing about, I think it was when the colonels bought a couple apartments in Sicily, so all the boys could have a place of operations when they're on their adventures over there.
Yeah, there's a lot. The history was pretty heavy and difficult.
And you know what? Because I don't want to wait another week, I'm going to look it up right now, and we're going to find out if Joseph Heller served. Well, they call his genre of writing satire and black comedy. Hmm. Yeah, in 1942, at age 19, he joined the U.S. Army Air Corps. 2 years later, he was sent to the Italian front, where he flew 60 combat missions as a B-25 bombardier. He remembered the war as fun in the beginning. You got the feeling that there was something glorious about it. On his return home, he felt like a hero. People think it quite remarkable that I was in combat in an airplane and I flew 60 missions, even though I tell him the missions were largely milk runs. And then he studied English and he became an author. He's a son of Jewish parents in Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah, there's a lot of there's the involvement of America in the war is complicated. Complicated.
But he basically, from the sound of it, this whole scenario is based on his experiences as a bombardier.
I'd say so. Yes. Yes. For sure. Like it's definitely going on. Like you can see that this is toned by experience. Not surprised.
It doesn't shock me either. I mean, if he hadn't served, I would have gone, wow, he's managed to kind of create a certain mood without having been there. That's pretty remarkable.
Yes. I'm interested in seeing what happens next week. It'll be fascinating, I'm sure.
Learning a little more of the puzzle?
Yeah, a little bit more. It'll be interesting, but yes.
Cool. It sounds like you're kind of getting into the book now.
A little bit, yeah.
Thank you for joining us. The music at the top of the podcast was Soap Runs by Rupert Gregson-Williams and Henry Gregson-Williams. It's from the 2019 Catch-22 adaptation. The music at the end of the podcast is, as always, I'm the Slime by Frank Zappa. You can find me over on Twitter at Dave_the_turnip.
You can find me at Rue McMoo, that's RooMcMoo on Twitter as well. And you can find our podcast on Twitter and Facebook with SMBSLT Podcast. And if you add an @gmail.com, you end up with our email.
Yep, we'd love to hear feedback on the chapter, on the book, previous books. If you have suggestions for future books you'd like us to read. If you know a little more about America and Italy's involvement in the Second World War and would like to educate us. I'd be very open to hearing about that from someone who is knowledgeable in the area. Until next week, happy reading, everyone. Stay safe, and we'll see you next time.